Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Enrico Belmonte.
Hey, Enrico. It's good to chat with you. And I think this one's going to come out in early May. It's the heart of springtime, and I think you'll have... And speaking of that, I looked out the window at a nest that's on the eaves. It's on the gutter downspout. It has a little crook in it as it comes under the down the side of the house. And a couple of jays, like blue jays, built a nest there.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. And today they were both up there, and there were three little, well, not little,
oh, really?
Three babies with their mouths wide open going, hey, feed me, feed me. So I think they were just born today.
Oh, that's incredible. So I'm also preparing the garden, you know, for the summer. Mm-hmm. With tomato and so on. So yeah. It's a quite a great time also here in Italy in spring, and to teach also children to know when the vegetables grow and when it's the right time to earn them.
It makes sense. For our friends in the southern hemispheres, as well, they're having harvest time and getting ready for winter, but you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
But anyway, hey, we were chatting yesterday with a couple other folks about, you know, trends and challenges and stuff like that. And we thought, you know, maybe we should expand on that a bit and talk about, you know, what are the current trends or current state? Is that kind of what you were thinking for an idea for today?
Yeah, that's a great idea because, you know, we are also living quite a lot of changes in the world. I mean, in politics and economics, you know, and these are also impacting what is reliability engineer and how the reliability culture can be taught inside the companies. And how can we move forward? You know, the boundary conditions have changed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're more constraints on budgets and you know, shorter timelines. But then we also have stuff, and I know you use AI for all kinds of things and is a great leverage for you. Yet it's still starting. It was, I got a email this morning from somebody saying, so what do I think about AI and reliability? What's the trend there? And it was... Yeah. Well, it's out there, and I get calls almost every week from an AI startup that wants to do something related to reliability engineering. And the last one was kind of disturbing because it was they wanted to do an app or an agent that would help people with reliability-centered maintenance, you know, for a factory or something like that, a bunch of the asset management stuff. And maintenance of it. And I was like, well, what do you know about that field? Oh, nothing. I just know how to create agents. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I think you're doomed already.
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of a bubble, right? It's a part of a bubble. Yeah.
And so I get those kind of messages fairly recently, and they're creating a product in hopes of a problem to solve. And I'm like, yeah, you need to think this through a little bit. So I think one of the trends is we all need to be careful about the, and I call it snake oil. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that phrase. It's where it's
this. No, it's the first time.
Yeah. Okay. So there used to be in late 1800s, early 2000s, these guys would be like traveling salesmen and they'd sell snake oil. And it was one of the products. And they had different tonics and all kinds of weird stuff. You know, rub this in your head, you'll never go bald. Drink this and you'll be cured forever. And it was just water with some herbs in it or something like that.
Okay, so now I got it. Yeah, what do you mean? Yeah.
And so I'm looking at it as there's And I think you hit it on the head, is there's a type of a bubble going on it, and a lot of people wanting to get in and get a piece of this AI boom and all this capability, and haven't really created a viable product yet, and are kind of searching for something that might work. And so we all have to be careful about the advertisements and the calls that go, this will improve your maintenance 100%. You'll never have a breakdown again. I'm like, well, yeah, let's think about this.
Okay, so that's, you have already touched two important points. The first one is related to the boundary condition that we are experiencing due to the economics and political situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the second one is the advent of AI. So if we start with the first topic, for the first part, say the changes that are ongoing on our planet. No? So at a macro level, let's say, what is really for me new, is the change of the dominating companies, that are developing product, and they are also requesting a lot of reliability engineering, right? So, for mm-hmm. example, I'm thinking of the AI giant with all the GPUs and all the stuff that requires a different approach to reliability engineer than, for example, washing machine or electromechanical product. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking also to all military company that they got a lot of money in the last years, and they are also hiring a lot of engineers for developing new weapons and new products. And I think this is quite a big change, because if I have like 15 years experience, but I haven't seen this kind of big change before. What is your experience with that?
Yeah, it's we have grown up in an era where there's regional conflicts or civil war type stuff, but there hasn't been a whole region or a whole like world war type scenarios.
Yeah.
And I hope we don't ever get to one of those. Yet the geopolitical stuff and the saber rattling is where it's kind of shake your weapons back and forth in front of them, make a bunch of noise. That kind of rhetoric and talk is like nothing I've heard before. And so I think there's been this shift over the last decade of, we need a better military so that we don't have to use it. And unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes you end up using it and then it gets out of control. But it's become, and I don't know all the details, and I think 50 years from now, we'll still be trying to unravel what in the world's really going on. But there's more conflict, there's more battles going on, all that kind of stuff, and more areas and more regions. And I think the various governments are saying, well, we need to spend more on military programs and systems and be more self-reliant. And that's all over the world. And so there is a big shift in funding. But when I was a teenager, the US was just coming out of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And so the military complex was kind of receding. They were fading away. And when I was in the Army, it was low budget and low budget even for training and stuff like that. It just, there wasn't anything worth getting all geared up for. And this time I served in the Army was the longest single period the U.S. Army has not been in a war or in an engagement or whatever they call it these days. So I was very lucky that way. But then the Gulf Wars, and then just one more event after another is we've been steadily somewhere. And I think it's wrong. I don't think all of these things are justified for a lot of reasons, but Yeah, I don't know if you served in the military, but if you did, you would understand my phrase is that the biggest group of pacifists in the world, the ones that really don't want war, are the soldiers.
Yeah.
Because we're the ones getting shot at.
Never heard of it. So, no, I didn't serve the military because in Italy was stopped. I think it was 1982 or something like that. So, therefore, so in my, when I was a student, there was big movements against the war in Iraq, for example, you know, these kind of things. But I mean, it was something, always something really, really far from our education, for example. So I never thought it was important to get sort of preparation in military or working on military stuff, you know. I thought it was not necessary in any case, you know, because the war is over, you know, at least in Europe. And things change pretty abruptly. And I think a lot of clever minds are now attracted due to the from the military due to this paradigm shift, you know.
So it's doing a couple of things, though. I think the bigger forces at play is not just that there's more military spending. I think that's one thing. There's less spending on other things, but it also is going on is that there's more inflation, right? There's more uncertainty in the environment and government. And I think Trump's got a big hand in this in one form or another without trying to be too political, but you never know if a tariff's in place one day or the next. There's some pasta dyes that for extruding pasta that I buy from Italy. And depending on the day, they say, well, we'll just have to figure out what it is when it hits the border and we'll let you know because they don't know. But that affects companies like Apple and Dell and Bosch and everybody else going, well, if we're having inflation and people are being cautious because of economic uncertainty, they're not going to buy a new washing machine. They're not going to buy a new house. They're not going to invest in this or that or the other thing. So those companies are starting to pull back on how much they produce. And they're looking to go to less expensive models versus more expensive models to meet customers where they're at. So there's ramifications in that affect us in our product development cycles and our manufacturing work that we do in reliability. So I think there's a bunch of those forces at it. It's not just the military spending, which to some extent creates opportunities. But it also is really affecting the consumer market, which drives most of our economies these days. So the unfortunate part is in the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, we haven't really been in a state of depression where the country's economy is receding, it's declining. And like my kids, they have no idea what that means. The stock market's always gone up.
Except for 2008, no, really?
Yeah, for a couple of weeks. Yeah, for a couple of, like a year or two, and then we're back pretty quickly, but not a 10-year malaise, not like Japan, where they went 20 years with an almost flat economy.
Yeah, this is different in Italy, for example, because I have been experiencing flattening economy since I was born, more or less. So it's like it's like that, you know, the growth is like 0.1 minus 0.1, 0.5. It's it's not so dynamic, you know? But I think you are now touching the second point, you know, the change of the behavior of the customers that is moving to low cost product due to the inflation, you know, and that is really impacting reliability, you know, or how reliability is seen by consumers, you know. And when the inflation goes up and, you know, you have less money to spend on the product, you probably sacrifice reliability. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you see it, and it's completely unrelated to reliability, but I've seen a handful of financial type stories and reports that the leisure market, the high end fashion, say handbags and dresses and fashion, high fashion type stuff, is really on a decline. There's just people are pulling back from doing any of that stuff. And there's all kinds of reasons, I'm sure. But there's some consolidation in those industries and stuff like that. But it's a pullback where it's like, you know, do I really need this $500 purse, or should I, you know, get more groceries? Or here in the States, people are trying to figure out how to get enough money to fill their tank gas in their car. I don't know if you're seeing that, the rise of gas prices.
I mean, if you are of course a customer, no? would you sacrifice reliability?
I wouldn't. I'm a reliability guy. I know better than that.
So you would say reliability is the number one, you know, characteristics that you are going to you want to buy on the product.
Yeah,
but what about exactly for you, which is not a statistic represent. You are like the 90th percentile.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories in the States now of people that used to shop at kind of a really nice store, you know, the higher end grocery store or higher end department store or clothing store, are now going to, you know, the secondhand clothing, or they're going to, there's a huge market for that here in the States. I don't know why that is. There's a store chain called Dollar Tree. And there's another one, Dollar General. They compete with each other. And I think they both started with they sell everything in their store costs $1. Mm-hmm. And I think they're one of them's cheating now and saying, well, it's $1.25 or $1.50 or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But they're getting a lot more traffic. And the discount stores are getting a lot more traffic. But the higher end stores like Macy's for clothing, is a high-end brand or a high-end chain that is in the States, they're hurting. They're not selling as much, but the discount stores are seeing way more traffic.
But if you are a company, you know, you want to keep your margin, or at least you want to be profitable, you know, do you agree with me there's no chance to be, say, more to save on cost and partly to increase reliability? So the decrease of the cost of the product, it goes hand by hand with decrease of reliability.
I don't agree with that necessarily. A lot of companies operate that way. As soon as there's a financial setback or turn in the economy, consultants, training, and quality all take a hit. We'll still crank out widgets. So the design team and the manufacturing teams, they need to be there, but we'll get rid of all these, in its air quotes here, auxiliary things, discretionary things. And if a company thinks of reliability or quality as discretionary, then they're going to sacrifice that. But back to your point of that, the cost of the product is, you know, part of, is reflects the, it's not the way you didn't say it reflects the reliability of the product, but there's two pieces to this. One is when done well, right? Reliability, if it's embedded in the organization and the whole organization understands, is just part of creating a good product right from the start. It's actually pretty inexpensive to do this. Right. In, you save money then also, then lower warranty costs, higher customer satisfaction, and you do all these other benefits of it. So it's not if I put a dollar extra into the design, I get 1 year more reliability. No, it's the thinking through and solving the right problems and all the way through. It's not a focus on cost reduction. It's not a focus on time to market only. It's balanced with the quality reliability. Unfortunately, a lot of companies don't think of it that way. Now, I did a study when I was at Hewlett Packard, and we had 50 product lines, 50 different divisions that operated pretty independently. And I interviewed and worked with each one of them to understand what they did and didn't do. And the advantage I had is I also had access to all of their warranty payments, how much they were paying in warranty each year. And I thought that the more reliability stuff you do, you know, you do accelerated testing and HALT and FMEA and the whole list of things that we can do, the lower your warranty would be. And that only went so far. And so some of the groups that did the most activities and said, yeah, we do all these things. And my talking to him was questionable that they did very many of them well. They were more like, we're just too busy. We can't really get enough samples to do this accelerated test. But we do the accelerated test. And it's, do you use the information? No, we don't have time to do that. And like, okay. So they're doing a lot of stuff, but they were paying a nominal, kind of the average amount of warranty expense per product line that we had. There were other groups that used very few tools and techniques in the development of a product. And they weren't always consistent. They really depended on that particular product and what its particular situation was. And they might or might not do an FMEA or HALT or even an environmental test. But they did, and they had very low warranty expenses. Yeah. And the other group that had very little use of reliability stuff, the identifiable tools, as we would call it, pretty much ignored reliability. They just didn't know what it was or didn't want to do it and thought it was a cost or a something in the way of getting products out. And they had the highest warranty. The difference was that the first group that had the highest warranty didn't think it was important at all and we'll just ignore it. Product customers always complain. It was a literal quote I heard from a general manager once that had a horrible warranty problem. And he said, we don't do reliability. Customers always complain. Don't worry about it. And they were spending 50. They had a 2-year warranty on that product and they had 50% per year failures in the field. So they that's replaced huge. Two of them for every product they sold.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's odd. Yeah.
Now, on the opposite end of that spectrum is teams that very deliberately chose the tools and techniques and methods that would actually help them, and they only did those things. So, but derating and stress strength calculations and those kind of things, that was just normal business. That wasn't an add-on or extra or anything else. It was just what the engineering teams did. And if one of them said, hey, I'm not really sure if this is the right component. We're running it a little bit hot. We kind of have these trade-offs. We need to run an accelerated test on it. And then they would get a reliability person to help them design and run the test. And then they'd make a decision. Do we increase this component and change some of the design or can we use it? But they would not run an accelerated test just because that's what you do when you do reliability.
Yeah, I would say you have touched the important points, and I would like to also to summarize a little bit them. So I think that the first point you mentioned is really powerful also for the listener, the people that are listening to our podcast. I mean, reducing the cost and reducing reliability. So reducing the cost might lead to a worse reliability, right? Mm-hmm. So because you can just take the cheaper component and replace the normal one with a cheaper one, and you save money, but at the end you might get a lot of worse consequences in terms of reliability. You know, so that is quite an important message. I think it's pretty clear to be understood, but in complicated companies, complicated organization, it's quite hard to be implemented. You need a mature organization which is aware of the impact of reliability and is also able to use the right tools at the right time. I think this is really important. At the end, what we are saying that a company needs good engineers to implement reliability in the proper way. You know, and if we come back to the beginning of our discussion where we said, okay, so AI is doing a lot of things, you know, and we can replace engineers by AI. They are doing maintenance by itself without knowing anything. No, that's not the right way to do that. The AI might be a really powerful tool, but you need the right people using it. So. Yeah. It's a topic of organization maturity, and you have also created this wonderful maturity metrics for organization that I recommend our listener to look at in your book. And you know, it's the awareness of using the right tools for the right problems, and not just doing FMEA because it has to be done. No, and you know what? Let me add one point. If you have a good pool of reliability engineers, you know, you need also to have a level of maturity in the organization that, through design reviews, is able to judge, to evaluate what the teams are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's I think is really underrated. Topic, you know, do you hire reliability engineer and then you say, hey, he's a reliability engineer, he can do whatever he wants, you know, and nobody's checking, you know, if it's like doing accelerated lifetime, taking a lot of assumption, yeah. You know, the reliability is a result of people working well together and apply reliability engineer in the proper way. You know, and I think this is the key, which it can be really straightforward, but you know, that helps also to save a lot of money in the products.
Yeah, and I agree. It's in a lot of the forces and are changing. I think the way you phrase it is boundary conditions. It's, you know, it's putting a squeeze on many organizations to reduce costs. If the work of your engineering teams are seen as valuable and as they achieve really high reliability, it's much harder to cut those because there's a clear connection between if we select the right components and if we do the due diligence and use the right tools when we need to, not only do we spend less money in the design process, we also save money on the products in the field. Once that's established, and that's what I mean by a more mature company from a reliability point of view, it's really hard to stop that. And so but it's getting out into that realm that's difficult. It takes effort. It takes a lot of energy to make it happen.
Yeah.
But it's something to consider as more and more organizations are facing decisions about primarily budget and all the uncertainty we got, is being very clear where the value is. Why is reliability important is a key piece of that. And so it's, I like to say this, you never want to let a good disaster go to waste. So it's you want to make sure that you can get what you need to move forward on the reliability front because it does make a real difference. I think we've got challenges. The world has got all kinds of challenges. I don't think that's going to stop ever. There's going to be one form of disaster or challenge after another. But I think having a clear picture of where the value lies, how we make a difference in organizations, and make sure it's communicated well, you got a better shot at it and a really satisfying career.
Yeah, it is a wonderful summary of our discussion, Fred. So value behind reliability decision.
Yep.
And that's sometimes it's quite hard to do, but it's essential. Yeah,
yep, it really is.
To show up and
that might be topic. That might be a topic for a future one as well. How do you do it?
Yeah, especially what kind of KPI we want to. How do you collect data on that? Yeah. Which is quite tricky, you know.
It's not. It actually isn't all that hard. We'll save that for another discussion. Another day.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much, Fred. Yeah.
All right. You're very welcome. Thanks so much, Enrico. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us for this podcast. And if you'd like to send over a comment or a question, or if you have an idea of, you know, how is the current world affairs, you know, impacting you and your organization, let us know. And, over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Enrico and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our About pages. So there's plenty of ways for you to get in touch, and we look forward to hearing from you. So thanks again for listening. And thanks so much for the discussion, Enrico.
Thank you very much, Fred.
Talk to you later. Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.